Thank you for being here today, Krista. Tell me about your background and what brought you to Microsoft Research.
So I came to Microsoft Research back in 2006 after I finished my PhD in computer science at Columbia. And I came to Microsoft Research really because it's really the top place to work for computer science PhDs in industry. The people here are amazing, problems amazing, and just a really fantastic place to work. So I wanted to come here to really work on a set of problems and have freedom in research and to work with the people that were here.
Are quantum computers, do they exist today, or are they mostly theoretical?
So we have seen in the newspaper, quantum computers exist. We've seen a company from Canada, D-Wave, claim to have a quantum computer. I would say that, in fact, we have quantum devices that exist, and we don't yet have what I call a universal quantum computer, what we call in the field a universal quantum computer in existence, a quantum computer that could perform any quantum algorithm that we give it. That doesn't exist yet today.
What are some of the challenges that you have as a computer scientist with universal quantum computers not existing and what you have to do in the meantime?
As a computer scientist, we're faced with the challenge of actually building out the whole system in terms of the interaction between the classical computer that controls the quantum computer, the language that needs to describe that has to take into account both the classical instruction set and the quantum instruction set. How do those systems interact? So in computer science, we're really thinking about building out the whole compiler and understanding how those controls, how the feedback loops work. How do we control the quantum computer? The universal issue is really we have to be able to take any quantum algorithm, any quantum circuit that we program, we need to be able to run on the quantum device, on the quantum computer, eventually universal quantum computer. And that's where building Liquid, our software architecture, is really key. Having a complete solid design flow that will allow this mapping in an automated fashion and an efficient fashion has a great set of challenges along that design flow, and that fun set of problems for computer scientists.
So with a digital computer, I can look and see if I'm at a one or a zero. Can you look at the state on a quantum computer? Because looking at the state, that's
sure.
One of the problems, isn't it?
Right, so you can look at the state, but there are consequences.
Yeah.
So naturally, in a quantum computer, it wants to remain, the qubits want to be in their vacuum. They want to be isolated from the environment. The more it interacts with the environment, the more it undergoes a process, which we call decoherence. And decoherence essentially means that the quantum system collapses back to a classical system. So instead of being on this dimmer, the dimmer will flip to either on or off if I open the box and look at the system, if I measure the system, is what we say. So as soon as I measure, I'm back to just a classical zero or one, essentially. So you can look at the system with consequences. And so essentially in quantum algorithms, when we compute on a quantum computer, we will try to avoid, what we want to do is allow the quantum computer to get into a state to transform into a state where when we look at it, it's in the state we need. It's already in the answer state, mm-hmm. essentially.
So in 1983, Heinz Pagels wrote about how computers were then getting to the size where a high energy charged particle from like natural radiation or a cosmic ray could cause soft errors. It could go through a piece of silicon and flip a one to a zero and cause some problems.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of problem exacerbated at the quantum level?
What you're referring to is a noise process,
yeah.
an error process. And in classical digital computers, we have this problem at some levels, but they're pretty robust.
Yeah.
And we don't have to worry about this too much. In a quantum computer, that's not the case. First, these systems sit at extremely low temperatures in most cases. There are some qubit devices that might sit at higher temperatures, but most are sitting at something like 20 millikelvin. Coldest place in the universe, they say, is in a dilution refrigerator, which is where our qubit sits. So there, we're trying to isolate it from noise, exactly what you're talking about. Noise is a huge problem, and we have to do a lot in quantum computing to overcome that. And what I mean by a lot is we need software, essentially kind of a software error correction level. So we take advantage of mathematical models, you know, redundancy, things like redundancy, error correcting codes, other things where we'll use multiple physical qubits to represent one logical qubit, so that if errors occur on the physical qubits, you know, maybe we can still get away with a clean logical qubit. So we have to have a lot of additional resources that we use to protect against these noise processes,
yeah,
which are a big problem.
Can you explain what a qubit is for those of us who are more familiar with qubit?
Yes, so a qubit is our analog to a classical bit. So qubit stands for quantum bit, and it's no longer just binary. The qubit is, you can view it, you know, mathematically, we view it as a vector, a complex vector. So if you just think of a two-dimensional vector, you have two entries in the vector. One represents the amplitude on the zero state, the other represents the amplitude on the one state. And we have a superposition between 0 and 1 for a qubit. It's not just on or off. It can be anywhere in between. And so what this means is these values for the qubit, they can be, you know, you can be partly on the 0 side, partly on the 1 side. You could be equally in equal superposition. So I'm halfway between 0 and 1. And so a qubit is this linear combination of 0 and 1.
What are the biggest challenges towards building a quantum computer today?
We have several challenges in building a quantum computer. So one is the noise problem, that quantum computers need to be isolated, often in very cold environments. Protecting them from noise at a mathematical level is a challenge, but we have some amazing codes we can use to help protect against that. So achieving scalability and fault tolerance with quantum error correction seems very feasible now. But the technologies have to reach a certain, what we call threshold or fidelity of the gates. The gates have to be at least a certain reliability in order for the error correction to actually work. And what's exciting right now is that in the last year, there have been several demonstrations that the gates now have reached the fidelities necessary for error correction to work. So we're starting to overcome that hurdle, but now we have to scale out. So we hear about qubits, we hear quantum computers, you know, that there are qubits that exist, but we're talking, you know, tens of qubits. I think maybe the maximum currently is around 14 qubits have been shown, you know, in one system, and I think that was in an ion trap system. In superconducting qubits, we have, I believe right now, maybe around five is the largest, and now they're working to getting 9 to act coherently together, to apply gates to them, to show, you know, a small computation. And in fact, they want to show a small error correction demonstration with just this many. So one of the hurdles right now is now scaling up these systems to many qubits, because if we want to run a problem, we want to compute on a quantum computer, we need you know, hundreds, thousands, 10,000 qubits acting together. And with quantum error correction, if you use a system, for example, with superconducting qubits, now you're looking at, you need 10,000 qubits to do maybe, you know, a 10 qubit algorithm, because I need that overhead for error correction. We hope that in the system we look at, topological qubits, we hope that that scaling will be, will have less overhead, that maybe we can get away with fewer, you know, qubits needed for the error correction process. But scaling out to 100 qubits hasn't been done yet. So the scaling out is a challenge. And then we need to control the system. So a quantum computer doesn't just work on its own. It needs a classical computer to control it. And that's a really interesting, non-trivial problem, building the classical computer that controls the quantum computer. You know, we have a quantum computer sitting down in the cold. We need to run superconducting lines through a fridge. We may need to take care of the heat dissipation that might occur. You know, we're controlling thousands of qubits at a cold temperature. That's a lot of multiplexing and communication. We have to look at the latency and the speed. That's going to, set our clock speed of our quantum computer. And all of that's going to be a, fun problem to look at as we scale out the number of qubits. So just controlling them and being able to read out in quantum error correction, measurement is actually part of the process. We measure out to see, have errors occurred? So we're not looking at the logical state, but we look to see if errors occurred. And that all needs to be fed back up to the classical computer in a fast enough cycle that we can continue correct the errors, continue with our algorithms. So I think the scaling problem, even on the classical electronic side, we've never run classical chips at 4 Kelvin.
When I think of a computer, I think of a pretty much a single device that's in one area. Does quantum entanglement allow a quantum computer to exist in multiple places around the world?
So in terms of quantum entanglement, we'd first take advantage of that at just a single quantum chip level. Mm-hmm. We have to have entanglement to achieve these speed ups that we look at for quantum algorithms and to get the kind of exponential increase in terms of kind of this massive parallelism that we take advantage of in a quantum computer with qubits in superposition and then entangled across the system. Now, it's true, in for example, quantum teleportation, we can take, we can take a qubit, interact, or two qubits, do some quantum gates on them, take one across to the edge of the universe, and then I act on, I give one to you and you go to the edge, I stay here, and then I do something to my qubit, it simultaneously does something to yours. So that's the magic of entanglement.
Like instantaneous Morse code.
It's instantaneous. Now, there's some catches, because I have to send you some information classically, so I'm limited by the speed of light and how fast I can send that classical information to you. But the quantum process actually occurred instantaneously. Now, in terms of using that for connecting quantum computers around the world, possibly. But right now we think of using quantum entanglement more for communication, secure communication, less thinking about networked quantum computers at this point, because we need to just master the entanglement on a single quantum computer level.
Yeah.
But it is used for quantum key distribution, for secure communication. And those processes and systems exist. You can buy quantum key devices now and send information securely from two mountains, between mountains.
Yeah.
That's been demonstrated. In terms of using it for a network, potentially, yeah. Most of the time right now we think of maybe using a photonic qubit to build quantum networks between quantum computers, and that's being developed right now. And that does use entanglement channels.
What's unique about Microsoft's approach to quantum computing compared to what others are doing in the field?
So here at Microsoft, we have a unique approach in how we're set up in terms of tackling the challenges of quantum computing, and that we have a group at Microsoft Research in Redmond. We have the Quantum Architectures and Computation Group, which focuses on the computer science problems. In Santa Barbara, we have Station Q, which focuses more on the theoretical physics problems. And then we also work with experimentalists around the world, university professors, who actually then try to experiment and build these qubits. And so we have a unique setup in that we're talking to physicists, mathematicians, computer scientists, and then we also have a unique approach behind that, which is the topological qubits. And topological qubits were developed, I'd say, in the last 10, 15 years. And Michael Friedman was one of the primary drivers of that research. And what they found is that by taking advantage of things, something called topology, the topology of a system, that if you stretch things apart, the topology isn't changing. And so if you take advantage of topology, it can offer some natural, what we call hardware protection against noise. in conventional, what I call conventional qubits, meaning not topological qubits, so superconducting qubits, ion traps, qubits of that sort, of that nature, they need a lot of software error correction to protect against errors, because the information is stored just in the spin or just in the state of this atom. If that atom gets perturbed or a noise process occurs on that atom, you've lost your information. But in the topological qubits now, it's spread across some topology, the information. So my information is actually stored non-locally, which means in storing maybe the information in two distant or across a chain, across a whole lattice, or in our case, we talk about what are called Majorana zero modes, which occur on the ends of a nanowire. So the information is stored across this nanowire, and it's harder to perturb this system. Just causing an error on one side will actually not cause this qubit to decohere. And so this topological property is key behind what we call topological qubits and the systems we're looking at. So it's a very unique approach, and the hope is that this would then allow us to use far fewer resources to do a full quantum algorithm than, say, conventional qubits. We'll need less overhead for quantum error correction. That's the hope.
Are the programming languages that exist today sufficient for quantum computing, or do we need to rethink the way that we interface with computers?
Right. So our existing programming languages don't have a notion of a qubit, and they don't. In a quantum programming language, we really want to protect or prevent the programmer from doing things that aren't allowed by quantum mechanics and quantum computation. You can't clone. You can't just copy. You know, as a classical programmer, we copy arrays, we'll copy a variable. We're copying all the time. We cannot, it's not allowed in quantum mechanics. There's a no cloning principle. And so we'd like the programming language, for example, to prevent things like cloning from happening. You also need to make sure that things are unitary, that it maintains the reversibility. And so you want the programming language to automatically know the restrictions you have on the kind of mathematical model or the principles of quantum mechanics. So we've actually developed in my group, we've been developing a whole software architecture that includes a domain-specific language, in fact, that's embedded in F#, which was also developed at Microsoft Research. And there, it's nice to have a functional language for quantum computing, because everything is really thought about in terms of functions, unitaries acting on states. And so then we can represent all of these as functions and subroutines that we can call, you know, within a quantum circuit. And our embedded language tries to encode some of these principles, like, for example, no cloning or reversibility, we hope restricts the user from doing things that are illegal in quantum mechanics.
Tell me about Liquid.
So Liquid is something we've been developing in Quark, in our group here, that is a full software architecture for quantum computing. So we think of compilers in classical computing taking a high-level algorithm all the way down to the target representation, right, down to the hardware code. Same thing in quantum computers. We need to take a high-level quantum algorithm, and we need to translate it, compile it, into code that can run on a quantum device. And so Liquid is this complete compiler, this complete system, a software architecture for this. It includes the high-level language that you can program your quantum circuit that represents your quantum algorithm in at the highest level. It will then translate that to quantum circuits that operate over a certain set of gates. For example, your device might be limited in terms of what gate set it can perform. And so you need to take something that was very that was more general and actually now map it to something more specific to your device. So Liquid performs those processes, then it also performs optimizations on that. So we want to reduce the number of gates, for example, in the circuit. We actually want to reduce one gate in particular that tends to be more expensive due to things we have to do for error correction and other operations. So what we do there is then try to minimize the occurrence of that gate by replacing the circuit in different ways, such that it's still mathematically equivalent, still producing the same answer. So Liquid does this series of compiler steps of translation, optimization. Then it also has nice things like rendering. If I want to, you know, as a quantum programmer, we want to check our circuits, we want to try new ideas, we want to play with what could we do with quantum algorithms, what new problems can we attack with a quantum computer. We'll try different circuit designs, and Liquid allows us to play with this. So in present day, we have simulators where we can simulate these quantum circuits. And so Liquid also includes, as a possible backend, a variety of simulators depending on the problem you're looking at. But in terms of universal simulator, I want to simulate any quantum circuit I program. We can actually now simulate up to 31 qubits on your laptop, 32 gigs of RAM. This is actually state of the art. 31 might not sound large, but if you try to simulate 200 qubits, you need something like 10 to the 60 classical bits. So that's a huge system. Yeah. So 31 qubits on your laptop is, we're very excited about simulating that many. And you can do a lot of nice small problems with 31 qubits. So Liquid also includes these backends, visualization tools, rendering tools to look at the quantum circuit and debug visually, things of that sort. So it's a complete compiler system, complete software architecture for quantum computing.
So I take it Microsoft doesn't have a quantum computer today.
No, we don't have a quantum computer today.
Do we have a sense of how long it'll be before this is something that'll be widely adopted or able to be used widespread?
Right. So our interest is really in advancing the state of quantum computing from the theory side, from, you know, the experiment side. We'd like to see a topological qubit in the next few years. In terms of the scale and time frame of quantum computing more generally, we have, for conventional qubits, you know, we have maybe 10, order of 10 qubits currently. And scaling that out will take time. And I think, you know, it's hard to state an exact time frame, but I'm hopeful that, say, in 10 years, we could do something that we cannot perform on a classical computer. We could do that on a very small quantum computer, so say 100 qubits. For a complete, large, scalable quantum computer, talking tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of qubits, you know, that's definitely further down the road. But I hope in the next, say, 10 years, we can do something we can't do on a classical computer.
What are some of the problems? What's possible with a quantum computer?
So studying physical systems is really interesting for a quantum computer, and there we have examples where we can get exponential speed up. Applications of that are in the area, for example, finding catalysts, understanding reaction pathways. That's useful for fertilizer production. So we actually use a large amount of energy. Say 2% of the world's energy usage goes to fertilizer, artificial fertilizer production. And there it's because the temperatures required, the atmospheric pressure required is so high in order to convert nitrogen to ammonia. That process they've been studying, chemists have been looking at for a long time to find a catalyst to reduce the amount of energy required to perform that process. A quantum computer would allow us to search for a catalyst that would allow which would reduce the energy required for that process, and that could be revolutionary in terms of, you know, the world food production. So that's one example where the simulation of physical systems really can make a difference, and quantum computers could potentially help.
What does quantum computing mean to machine learning?
Quantum computing for machine learning is something we're actively looking at right now. It's just starting to be studied in quantum computing. What we think is possible, so we know quantum computers give exponential speedups for problems, for example, Shor's algorithm, simulation of physical systems. The question is, could we get exponential speedups for areas of problems in, you know, big data learning problems, data analysis problems, machine learning. And there we're still actively looking. We have some new results showing that we can get speed ups, quadratic speed ups, in problems like nearest neighbor classification, so various classification problems. And what I like to think in terms of machine learning and quantum computing is, what questions can we ask now that we have a quantum computer that are different from the questions we ask in machine learning traditionally? So now we have access to new probability distributions, maybe new inference techniques. What does that give us for machine learning? It could give us much better models of users, systems, you know, whatever we're studying. So what I think is really exciting in the area of machine learning and quantum computing is the ability to ask these new questions, not necessarily just look for these speed ups. Speed ups might not be as important as being able to ask a new question. So this could really give a huge shift in what we can do with machine learning. That's an area we're really excited about.